This is Jeff Blankfort welcoming you to the November 22nd, 2017 edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Today marks the 54th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas, an event whose significance has not been diminished over the passage of time, despite the best efforts of the government and a complicit media, alternative as well as mainstream, to make you think it has. Despite the publication of a number of books exposing the Warren Commission's report on the assassination for what it was, a shoddy work of fiction designed not to find the truth, but to confirm that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin. Despite a congressional investigating committee having concluded 13 years later that there was more than one shooter and that JFK was likely the victim of a conspiracy, the media still tell us, when they chose to mention it, that Oswald killed the president and that he acted alone. And the American public, despite multiple polls showing that the majority still believes it was a conspiracy, has let them get away with it. What inquiries the media have made have largely limited to asking people where they were and what they were doing when they heard the news, or to speculate on what the country might be like had Kennedy lived to complete his term in office. That would be a very good question if those who bring us the news had the courage to interview those who have seriously investigated the president's murder and opened the long overdue discussion on why he was killed, who was behind the assassination, and why it was important. A mountain of evidence, much of it contained within the 26 volumes of the Warren Report, but ignored in its conclusions, reveal Oswald to have been a government agent and eventually its patsy, as he would claim moments before being gunned down by Jack Ruby. That alone should have led to the conclusion that the president's assassination was an inside job. But it is only part of the evidence pointing to it having been a CIA operation that drew in the Secret Service, which was charged with protecting the president's life, yet knowingly collaborated in his death. 4 years ago, I came upon a remarkable book that dissected the assassination plot in a manner I had not seen before or since. It was titled JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters, and on November 27, 2013, I interviewed its author, James Douglas, on Takes on the World. I'll be playing that interview for you again today on this anniversary of President Kennedy's murder. I should note that I once believed, as did Noam Chomsky, to this day, that Kennedy was an unrepentant cold warrior, essentially no different than Lyndon Johnson, that his assassination was of no consequence and not worth discussing. If you think that way, I suspect that if you're listening to Jim Douglas, you will, like me, change your mind. You will come to understand, as Douglas explains it, that without JFK's resistance to the demands of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and his inner circle, including Brother Robert, to bomb Cuba and destroy the nuclear missile launchers that the Soviets had installed there a year before his death, and without his secret back-channel communications with Soviet Prime Minister Nikita Khrushchev that peacefully resolved the crisis without informing the CIA, none of us would be alive today. None of us would be alive today. You will also hear how, despite expressions of disbelief from many on the left, Kennedy was quite serious about withdrawing all U.S. troops from Vietnam, beginning with 1,000 in 1963, and the remainder after he was reelected, an order which, on taking office, President Johnson quickly reversed. Kennedy's overall withdrawal plans had to be expressed privately, since doing so publicly before the 1964 election would have been unthinkable given the anti-communist tenor of the times. All this Douglas documents in his book. Chomsky will have none of this, as he wrote in Z Magazine several years ago. He says, "I know very little about the assassination. The only thing I've written about," said Chomsky, "is that the claim that it was a high-level conspiracy with policy significance is implausible to a quite extraordinary degree. History isn't physics, and even in physics, nothing is really proven. But the evidence against this claim is overwhelming from every testable point of view, remarkably so for a historical event." Given that conclusion, writes Chomsky, which I think is very well founded, that I have written about a lot, I have no further interest in the assassination, and while I've read a few of the books out of curiosity, I haven't given the matter any attention and have no opinion about how or why JFK was killed. "People shouldn't be killed," wrote Chomsky, "whether they are presidents or kids in the urban slums. Killing's not far from the White House." End quote. Noam Chomsky. I would note, however, apart from the obvious contradictions that jump out from that statement, that Chomsky has the same dismissive attitude toward those like me who speak about the power of the Israel lobby over Congress and those who question the official government narrative of the events of 9/11. But you'll be the judge of his stance on Kennedy after listening to what Jim Douglas has to say. Kennedy, to be sure, was the consummate Cold Warrior in his first year in office, stepping up U.S. involvement in Vietnam, escalating U.S. operations in Latin America, and approving the Bay of Pigs fiasco. But after that, he apparently went through some changes that he kept to himself and became what might be seen as a hero of a Shakespearean play, surrounded by those he trusted who betrayed him, and enemies, some within his own White House and others outside of it, who considered him a traitor who had to be eliminated. One of them, which is never mentioned by Chomsky, nor discussed in Douglas's book, for that matter, was Israeli First Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion, since Kennedy had taken positions on three key issues that Ben-Gurion found completely unacceptable. The most widely known was his opposition to Israel developing a nuclear weapon, and he was furious at Ben-Gurion's efforts to deceive him. When in 1960 the Eisenhower administration sought an explanation for Israel's mysterious construction near Dimona, the U.S. was told that this top-secret activity in the middle of the desert was a harmless textile plant and that visitors weren't welcome. When Kennedy took office in 61, the disagreement became a full-blown crisis. The inspections by his administration's representatives that were allowed to take place proved to be clever exercises in deception. When Ben-Gurion was denied an invitation to the White House, a meeting arranged between the two leaders at the New York's Waldorf Astoria Hotel in May 1961 was dominated by the nuclear issue. For the next 2 years, Ben-Gurion kept stalling over Kennedy's request for a genuine inspection until finally the president had had enough. In a personal letter to the Israeli Prime Minister dated May 18, 1963, the president wrote, quote, "We are concerned with the disturbing effects on world stability which would accompany the development of nuclear weapons capability by Israel." And he warned that unless American inspectors were allowed to inspect Dimona, Israel would find itself totally isolated. Rather than responding, Ben-Gurion resigned as prime minister. His Eshkol received Kennedy's next letter, which upped the pressure, warning that the American commitment and support of Israel, quote, could be seriously jeopardized. Before that could happen, JFK was assassinated, and with the arrival in the White House of Lyndon Johnson, Israel had nothing more to worry about. Not only were there no demands from the LBJ White House for Israel to curtail its nuclear activities, but under Johnson, the U.S. looked the other way when covert shipments of enriched uranium from the NUMEC plant in Pennsylvania, owned by a major supporter of Israel, were shipped to Dimona, as Graham Smith of the Institute for Research in Middle East Policy has written about and previously described on this program. Furthermore, in the spring of 1963, in hearings of the Foreign Relations Committee chaired by Senator William Fulbright, it was revealed that the quasi-governmental Jewish agency in Israel had funneled the equivalent of several hundred thousand dollars in today's currency stemming from tax-free donations to Israel from American Jews back across the water to the American Zionist Council, or AZC, the Israel lobby of its day. A year earlier, Kennedy had ordered the Justice Department to have the AZC register as a foreign agent, and these efforts continued through the Fulbright hearings. In response, the American Zionist Council lawyers pulled out all the legal stops to frustrate the demand of the Foreign Agents Registration Department that the lobbying organization comply with the U.S. law until Kennedy's assassination effectively brought the government's efforts to a close. Had the American Zionist Council been forced to register, many, if not most, of the activities of AIPAC, which succeeded the AZC, and other Jewish institutions that lobby on Israel's behalf would have been severely restricted because all would have, in all likelihood, would have been obliged to register as foreign agents, which in a very real sense they are, and this is their primary function today. Finally, JFK supported the right of Palestinians to return to their homeland, which the UN had enshrined in law. That he called on Israel to take back at least 300,000 refugees, 40% of the estimated 750,000 who had been ethnically cleansed in 1948, is a fact that remains largely unknown even by supporters of Palestinian rights. He would be the last president to take any of these positions. Not only did Lyndon Johnson reverse President Kennedy's position on Israel, but he did a 180-degree turn on every aspect of JFK's foreign policy, as we shall hear later in the program when I speak with Jim Douglas. I should make it clear that although Israel clearly benefited from Kennedy's assassination, there has never been any evidence that it was involved in the assassination, and moreover, there is no way that the Mossad, Israel's version of the CIA, could have carried out the operation on its own. The one angle that does connect Israel to it indirectly was the role played in the assassination by the legendary head of the CIA's counterintelligence department, James Jesus Angleton, who was responsible for handling the agency's communications with the Warren Commission. Angleton had two passions in his political life, a fervent hatred for communism and a love for Israel. This was revealed in a series of stories published over a number of weeks in the New York Jewish Weekly Forward a quarter century ago under the title Jesse and Teddy. Jesse was Angleton and Teddy was Teddy Kollek, identified by the FBI as a Mossad agent when he came to the United States and later became the mayor of Jerusalem. The stories published under a pseudonym describe the close friendship between the two men, about whom the mysterious author was clearly intimate. 3 years ago, that author casually revealed himself in an unrelated column. His name is Michael Ledeen, and if his name sounds familiar, he is a hardline pro-Israel neocon who is a fierce advocate of the war on Iraq, as he has been for regime change in Iran. While a paid consultant for the Defense Department, he was widely believed to have been responsible for the big lie told by President Bush in his 2000 State of the Union address that Saddam Hussein had obtained yellowcake uranium for nuclear weapon construction from Niger. Angleton, who put himself in charge of the CIA's Israel desk, was fired in 1974 after the Church Commission exposed some of the agency's skullduggery in which he had been intimately involved. After he passed away in 1987, his biographer Tom Mangold, in an interesting choice of words, would write, quote, "I would like to place on the record that Angleton's closest professional friends overseas came from the Mossad, that he was held in immense esteem by his Israeli colleagues and by the State of Israel, which was to award him profound honors after his death," end quote. Among those honors was a brass plaque and a forest planted in his name. Angleton had obviously served Israel well. Former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, inspired by JFK's announced vision, joined the agency in the year he was assassinated. Writing for Consortium News October 20th, McGovern points out that the long-awaited release of classified documents related to the assassination was, quote, "a tiny fraction of what had remained undisclosed in the National Archives." That the CIA and FBI are still choosing what we should be allowed to see concerning who murdered John Kennedy may seem unusual, notes McGovern, but there is a hoary precedent for it. After JFK's assassination, the well-connected Alan Dulles, whom Kennedy had fired as CIA director after the Bay of Pigs fiasco, got himself appointed to the Warren Commission and took the lead in shaping the investigation of JFK's murder. By becoming the de facto head of the commission, McGovern points out, Dulles was perfectly placed to protect himself and his associates if any commissioners or investigators were tempted to question whether Dulles and the CIA had played any role in killing Kennedy. When a few independent-minded journalists did succumb to that temptation, they were immediately branded, you guessed it, conspiracy theorists, writes McGovern. And so the big question remains. Did Alan Dulles and other cloak-and-dagger CIA operatives have a hand in John Kennedy's assassination and subsequent cover-up, asked McGovern. In my view, he writes, and the view of many more knowledgeable investigators, the best dissection of the evidence on the murder appears in James Douglas's 2008 book, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. After updating and arraying the abundant evidence and conducting still more interviews, Douglas concludes that the answer to the big question is yes. Reading Douglas's book today, concludes McGovern, may help explain why so many records are still withheld from release, even in redacted form, and why indeed we may never see them in their entirety, end quote, Ray McGovern. It is now 17 minutes past the hour, and time to revisit my November 27, 2013 interview with James Douglas about his groundbreaking book, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.